This election season is a stark reminder of the major role race plays not only in politics, but in many areas of our society, including criminal justice, housing, and jobs. Often overlooked is how it affects medicine and doctor-patient relations. In his book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race in Medicine, Dr. Damon Tweedy writes about how his race was a factor in medical school and continues to be a factor in diagnosis, socioeconomic background, and bills of health. His book is published by Picador, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Damon Tweedy to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's my pleasure to be here.
Before the Affordable Health Care Act, studies showed that black people were less likely to go to the doctor even when they had medical coverage. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think there are a lot of factors at work. So when you say someone has medical coverage, I mean, there's so many different degrees of what that entails. So there's, you know, there's private insurance, there's public, you know, and then there's public insurance with Medicaid and Medicare, and there's certain barriers to receiving care. If you have, you know, even if you have insurance, it doesn't mean that you still have access to the same types of doctors and quality of care. So that's one component to it. And then there's another component, which is in terms of the issues of stigma and the issues of concerns about the healthcare system itself and sort of being resistant and afraid in some ways of the healthcare system. So that's another sort of layer to a larger puzzle.
And why would there be fear of the healthcare system?
Yeah, so you know, it's interesting. So where my book sort of picks starts off is with this quote from Martin Luther King Jr. from 1966, where he talks about, the quote goes, "If all the forms of inequality, injustice, and health is the most shocking and the most inhumane." And so at that time, he was speaking to a group of physicians who were trying to advocate for change in the healthcare system. And in that world, I mean, there was this really, this is sort of an era still of segregation just sort of crumbling down. And there's a lot of stories, oral history, and there's just sort of stories of problems that African-Americans would encounter in the healthcare system, mistreatment, bias, just really not getting care at all. And so these are all things that sort of have a cultural memory in ways and often still, even in modern times, discourage people from seeking care.
Well, we've come a long way from the Tuskegee studies, but was there...
Well, yeah, so...
Go ahead.
No, so that was certainly going on during that time, right? So the Tuskegee study, it ended in 1972, which in some ways seems like a long period of time, but when you think about it, that's really just slightly more than a generation. So a lot of the lingering memories of that study and many others still linger today.
Are black patients more likely to seek out a black doctor?
It depends. So for some patients, for some groups of African-American patients, that's a really important issue, particularly in around certain disciplines. If you think about something like mental health, which is my field, psychiatry, but also in primary care, these are fields where the doctor and the patient relationship is in some ways even more paramount than it might be for a doctor who's sort of treating a dermatologist or an orthopedic surgeon who's sort of treating maybe a more discrete problem. So when you're talking about a relationship that lasts over time, yes. I mean, there's studies that I talk about in the book that point to that.
Because the reason I ask is I know I've spoken to a number of women about whether they prefer a male or female OBGYN or a gynecologist, and it almost splits down the middle.
Yes. So as a medical student, I've certainly been on, when I was rotating through my OBGYN rotation, I was certainly on the end of that, of many women particularly wanting a female gynecologist. But I think the thing about that is you have to be careful and not automatically just make assumptions, though, because like nowadays, if I see a female patient in the clinic, and I might make an assumption that she automatically wants to see a female psychiatrist or psychologist, and that's not always the case. So I think, you know, when you're talking about do black patients want to see a black doctor, I don't think we should just make a blanket assumption. But at the same time, there are many people for whom that is an important issue. And one of the realities of our healthcare system today is that, and particularly in many cities, you have large African-American populations, but very small numbers of African-American doctors. So, for instance, about 4% of the practicing doctors nationwide are African-American. And in many cities, for instance, Baltimore, it's 2/3 of the population is African-American. Here in North Carolina, in Durham, about 40% of the population is African-American. So you have this large sort of discrepancy between the population of patients and then the population of available physicians. So it can be an issue for many patients.
And is the reason that African-Americans are less likely to try to go to medical school?
There are a lot of factors at work here. So when you're talking about why are there fewer numbers of African-Americans in the healthcare field, it actually even has a gender split to it. So there was a report that came out about a year ago, published by, it's called the Association of American Medical Colleges, and they looked at this in some depth. And they found that African-American men in particular have not really, actually compared to 1978, the numbers are stagnant, which is really striking when you think about the numbers of all other demographic groups among physicians have increased considerably. So now African-American women outnumber African-American men in medical school 2-1. And I think there are a lot of, so the question is obviously is why. And I think there are a lot of barriers in place, a lot of factors in terms of what people see for themselves. The media in many ways crafts a narrative. I'm not trying to blame the media per se, but there's a narrative that's often crafted among about what African-American men can achieve and what the success looks like. And I think in some ways that's a huge factor. So because part of the problem is that there aren't enough people who are getting through the pipeline who are qualified to, you know, to go to college and then from college to medical school. So there's a huge gap there at the very early stages of life. So we're talking about needing reform in the education system and just a lot of other factors at work to really address that larger problem.
Had you always wanted to be a doctor?
No. So from personal experience, I grew up in suburban Washington, D.C., in Maryland, about 10 minutes outside the city, and it was in a community that was 100% African-American. And it was a working-class community. My dad worked as a meat cutter for a grocery store chain, and my mom worked for the federal government in an administrative sort of position. And there were no, you know, medical people in my family or community. So it was not something I would have conceived of myself. So, for instance, as a 12 or 13-year-old, the idea that I would, you know, be a doctor here 30 years later talking to you would have been inconceivable for me at that stage in my life. There weren't role models in medicine. The first time I actually saw an African-American physician, I was probably about 17. I mean, I actually saw someone in the flesh, and that was an older guy. And then the first time I saw someone who was sort of younger and I felt like I could relate to even more, I was in college. And that was really the first time that I began to think about medicine as a career for myself. So I think for a lot of people, it's just not even seeing people like yourself who are in those positions that really limits your own sense of who you can be.
Damon Tweedy is my guest. He's written a book that's was a New York Times bestseller when it was in hardcover and now available in paperback from Picador, called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I was wondering whether a black doctor might be more aware of some of the more common health problems that African Americans face and be more aware of some of the studies that have been done. It's been pointed out that many of the studies have excluded African Americans, but there still have been a fair number in recent years.
So what I would say is in medical school, they teach you about the health disparities, the differences in health outcomes based on race. So when you're in medical school, for instance, for me, 20 years ago, they would say, well, hypertension, high blood pressure, it's more common among African Americans.
Which you learned personally, didn't you? You were diagnosed with high blood pressure when you were very young.
Exactly. So they tell you this information, but what's not necessarily goes along with it is maybe understanding the context as to why and what are some of the barriers that maybe are more subtle as to why the person is having these problems, but then also maybe not having the outcome that a doctor would expect. So that's where having the experience of living in a community can be very advantageous. So I wouldn't say so much about the diagnosis, but about how do you manage it and where do you go from there? So for me, you know, as you mentioned, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure myself as a first-year medical student. I was 23 years old. I'd played basketball in college. I was, you know, thin and felt like I was in tip-top shape. And so it was a really striking, kind of devastating experience because it wasn't just high blood pressure. They also found that I had some early signs of kidney disease based on the tests that they ran. So it was really, at that time, seemed to be a really serious problem. And so for me as a medical student and then later as a doctor, I had a lot of knowledge about, you know, what to do about it. How do you change your diet? How do you do these different things to make things better? But I still struggled tremendously. And part of that struggle was a psychological struggle as to what it meant to sort of eat a certain way, to exercise a certain way. I had these sort of barriers in my mind that these were things that were for a certain segment of the population, you know, mainly well-to-do white people, whereas I come from a very lower working class African-American background. And so for me, it was like, well, if I'm going to eat, like today for lunch, I had a salad and, you know, a little bit of chicken on there and an apple. Now, for me, 30 years ago, that would have seemed like, why in the world would I eat food like that? You know, baked chicken, a salad. It would have felt like I was in some ways giving up a part of my identity, the way that I had grown up within my African-American community, the foods that I ate and how that was all tied together. And so understanding that as a doctor and your patient is something I don't think all doctors would necessarily understand or know what to do with that.
Well, how
so
much
for me, I've seen...
Oh, go ahead. Finish.
Okay. So what I would say to that is I've certainly seen patients myself over the years, and we've explored those kind of questions. And so because in a medical setting, a doctor might give a person a medication, and if they come back and the blood pressure is still high, they may give them another one, but not really understanding like what's getting in the way of this person sort of getting the changes that need to be made. And so that's where my own personal background in that kind of community can really be helpful.
How much of that is the result of diet and exercise and related matters? How much of it is genetic?
Yeah, so there's several theories. If you're talking about high blood pressure in particular, but really for other medical conditions.
Well, diabetes is another case that we see.
Yeah.
It's quite common in the African-American community.
So basically, and those two diseases in particular lead to heart disease, stroke, kidney disease. So you have this whole range of disorders that sort of all are connected. And in medical school, the mantra I adopted was that being black was somehow bad for your health. So again, there's a question as to why. So it was almost framed like it was strictly a, almost like a genetic or a biological aspect to it. And I think that's my experience is that that's a really small part to it. I think a much larger part is the socioeconomic aspect, the issues around diet, the issues around, you know, the community you live in, the stresses that you face. I think those are much, much larger factors in this problem. My own personal story is an example. So for me with high blood pressure, after I sort of got over that psychological challenge, I was able to, you know, adopt a healthy diet, no special name to the diet and nothing sort of magical, but just following a sensible diet, and my blood pressure has been completely normal for more than 10 years without medication. And so to me, that pre and post was strictly a factor of sort of diet and exercise and managing stress. And so I think that speaks true for a larger segment of African Americans as well. I think the idea that you can say it's genetic, I'm not saying we shouldn't look into those things, but to think that genetics is simply destiny, I think, is really short-sighted because it overlooks the ways in which people themselves can really impact health, own health.
You attended Duke University School of Medicine. Do you think you would have had a different education if you'd gone to a northern college?
That's a great question. And some, you know, because Duke is in North Carolina, and as I write in the book, Duke certainly has a history of racial problems. There's no doubt about that, particularly in the 60s and 70s, and even later on, it's had issues. But what I would say to that is that since the book's been out in the past year, I've had a chance to travel to various medical schools and interact with doctors, you know, black doctors from all across the country, and they have the same stories. And so in some ways, there may be a few things that would have been a little different. Like, for instance, at Duke, there were some, in the South, there are some people that are really tied to the old South and Confederacy and those things you might not see in New York. But as far as the more subtle things that happen that are much more common, the microaggressions, as they're called, those things happen everywhere.
And could you talk about those? You describe how you had to deal with race when you were in medical school.
Sure, yeah. So the book actually opens up after I sort of... So the goal of the book is to really talk about the health disparities, and I'm using patient stories of people to really illustrate all the factors that go into that, the socioeconomic, the doctor-patient relationship and those things. But then another big part of the story is my own journey of being an African-American man, going through medical training, and then what it's like for black doctors in a larger sense. So in the first chapter of the book, I describe a scene with me as a first-year medical student. And I'm leaving a lecture hall. There's a break between lectures, and then I go out to use the restroom and come back in the lecture hall. And a professor of the course, this is about 3 weeks into the semester, he comes up to me and confronts me at the entrance to the lecture hall. And he immediately says, are you here to fix the lights in the classroom? And I'm looking around thinking, is there someone else behind me, next to me? Realize it's just me and him. And he says, well, I called about this last week. Why haven't you done this? So he was really sort of amplified the exchange. And, I wanted to look for another explanation as to why he might think that I was in this role. And I said, well, no, I'm not here. And then, then his response was then, I said, I'm not here for this purpose. And he said, well, then why are you here in my class? And so for me, looking around, I wanted to find another explanation, but I was dressed the same way. I had the same books. And I could only come to this conclusion that, you know, he saw me differently because I stood out in this obvious way.
And were you the only black student in the class?
I wasn't the only black student in the class, although that's an experience I did have quite a bit. But at this point in time, Duke was actually in their very first year of increasing the numbers of African-American students in medical school. So that for many years, Duke had very few African-American students in their medical school classes. And this was basically the first year they had new leadership, and they were really trying to make a concerted effort to change that. And so it was sort of the contrast between the old ways and sort of what was becoming the new way of things. And this professor was an older person. He had sort of been in that system from the older way. So I think there may have been resistance in some way, whether conscious or otherwise, to the changes that were occurring.
You touch
this, this exchange we had was an expression of that.
You touch on something called best black syndrome. What's that?
Yeah, well, so that's the idea. Similar to that is this idea of when students, schools are trying to attract African-American students to medical schools and things like that. It's almost like a search to find the sort of the best black person, you know. So because it, as we said in the earlier on, there are a small number of sort of what they would call qualified African-American students because of so many other issues in our society. When you get to the point of a medical school application, there's a really small number of folks who are there available. And so schools go through great lengths to try and attract those students. And so that's sort of the context under which I found myself when I was applying to medical school.
My guest is Damon Tweedy. He's assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center and a staff physician at the Durham Veteran Affairs Medical Center. He has written a book that is now available in paperback, bestseller when it was in hardcover. It's called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. It's published by Picador. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Dr. Damon Tweedy. His book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine, now available in paperback from Picador. How did your African-American peers react when you told them about some of the experiences we've been talking about?
They were not surprised. Many of them felt like, and it's a quote from them, that I was actually telling their own story in so many ways. So what I found was that my book was in some ways a vehicle for them to kind of express their own challenges and triumphs over discrimination. And some of the stories they told were just incredible. I mean, things that were even far more egregious than things that I put in my own book.
But do you think your experiences and their experiences when told to others discourage African-Americans from entering medical school or hoping to move on to something in other areas of higher learning?
Well, two things. So one, I would say, is that those challenges are present in other fields as well. So I've had many people in the legal profession, the business world, share very similar stories. And some stories are in some ways even more challenging because there's even more subjectivity in some of those other fields. So I would say I don't think it would uniquely discourage them from going into medicine. And in many of the stories that I tell in the book are really stories of triumph and sort of overcoming these challenges. And so that's sort of how it's been framed. So I haven't gotten that impression that I'm sort of discouraging folks, because it's really just telling the truth in some ways. And so what's also been really interesting is how many of my former classmates, you know, who are primarily white and Asian, have come back to me and responded with surprise, because we were in the same school, same time, going through the same rotations and same hospital, but in some ways our experiences were so different, even though on the surface it seemed to be very similar. So I've had a lot of feedback along those lines as well. So I think it's in some ways it's been a way to open other people's eyes who might not be aware of some of these realities.
You write that you fainted from the sight of blood when you were in medical school.
Oh, no, that was actually college. So I'd gotten past that by the time I got to medical school. Yes, I was a little bit squeamish when I was working in a research lab when they were studying animals. And so the whole idea of doing surgery on rats was a little bit unsettling to me. And that was actually my very, very first day of a research lab. So that was like the worst first impression that one could make would be to pass out 5 minutes into your first internship experience.
Yeah,
so they rushed me to a hospital. So they rushed me to a hospital, and so I got a chance to interact with some really young doctors. So I tried to make the most of that and turn a bad into a good, because I started to shadow some of those doctors who treated me initially.
But it would make you think twice about wanting to become a doctor. What made you change your goal? You originally wanted to be a cardiologist, and then instead you switched to psychiatry.
Yeah, so the cardiology piece came from two things. That first research experience that I just described was actually working with a cardiologist, and he was a young African-American cardiologist. He had trained at Johns Hopkins, and that was the first time I really had a chance to really interact with a young African-American doctor. So there was that piece to it. Then also my own experience with high blood pressure and some family members who had had heart disease. My grandmother had died from heart failure early in my first year of medical school. So all those things made me think about cardiology as a career, because there's an enormous disparity in terms of health when you look at cardiovascular health among African Americans. So psychiatry I kind of fell into. I had a couple friends, close friends, who were also African American who suffered some pretty significant mental health problems, challenges when they were in graduate school and in medical school. And it really opened my eyes, because these are people who are really successful, and then they suddenly had this event happen to them, seemingly out of their control, and it really impacted and in some ways derailed what they were trying to accomplish. So that was really striking to me. At the same time, I also saw that there were a lot of people in the African-American community who had a lot of there's a lot of stigma around mental illness. I mean, there is in general, but even more so among the African-American community. There's a lot of fear of seeking medical care in that realm. And I felt like there was a great need. I mean, there's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of issues and so I felt like there was a role that I could play. But to be honest, when I first did my psychiatry rotation, again, not making the best first impression, when I interviewed a patient at the end of the rotation, the doctor suggested that I might want to become a pathologist who didn't actually treat living patients. So not to dismiss pathology as a great career, but his point was that I had really poor bedside manner. So it was a work in progress, but I've fallen into psychiatry over the years, and it's worked out very well for me.
Along these lines, a listener has tweeted us, can Dr. Tweedy address the crisis of access to quality, culturally literate mental health care? And are there any organizations that are addressing this?
Yeah, there actually is an association of black psychiatrists as well as psychologists who have a website, and they list some different providers and practitioners in various areas. But to be honest with you, there's a tremendous shortage of mental health providers, particularly if you're looking for someone within the as far as black psychologists and psychiatrists. There's definitely a shortage, but there are some web sources. If you look at those, Google those particular associations, and you'll find some information there. For different geographic regions, but that's a huge problem. And that's something that I've written about and talked about in other forums as well.
You've called one of your chapters Baby Mamas. Why did you pick mm-hmm. that name?
It's a term that's used. I don't particularly like that term. And it's often been associated with, African-American women in sort of our cultural lexicon. I really don't like the term itself, but I think it was the best way to illustrate some of the challenges that I was trying to present in that chapter, where I talk about this idea of single moms, young black women having children in really difficult socioeconomic situations, and really people coming with different sorts of biases and misperceptions, and just sort of trying to understand where people are coming from. It really was an eye-opening experience for me, because it was, despite my own background, which was not particularly well-to-do, I saw other challenges that I wasn't even aware of, and I saw the ways in which women, in many cases, were getting really inadequate care. And so I really wanted to illustrate in that sort of way.
Is there a perception among doctors and nurses that teen pregnancies are still a major problem in the black community? Haven't the rates gone down?
Oh, they've gone down a lot. If you compare it like to 20 years ago, the numbers have probably halved. But so the perceptions, though, are still strong. I mean, so one of the things that I highlight in the book are just the different examples of how African-American person can come into a medical setting, and the perception of that person can often be unfavorable. And so I talk about it often with many patients that I saw. Once where a guy came into a clinic, and he had high blood pressure, he had some chest pain, everything turned out to be okay medically, but because he was sort of questioning some of the doctor's recommendations, but in a very thoughtful way, in a very correct way, actually, they labeled him with a mental health problem. And it was just like, wow, why would they do that? But there was this, you know, this sort of perception of what this person could be and what they could do. And the story that really encapsulates that for me is, for me, I was a patient once where I had a knee injury, and I came into a urgent care clinic, and I had come from home working in the yard, and I was dressed casually, you know, sweatpants, not in my doctor attire. And, you know, the nurse was very nice, but then the doctor comes in, doesn't look at me, you know, the whole electronic medical record thing. But beyond that, he never really engages with me at all and just tells me, you'll be fine, you can leave, without examining my knee or anything. And then, you know, me being a doctor, knowing that that was not the standard of care that was appropriate, I mentioned some vague medical terms, and suddenly he got more interested and finally realized that I was a doctor, and the entire thing changed. He's like, well, now I have to examine your knee. I want to get an x-ray. I want to do this. And so it was really being two different people. It was an illustration of how you could just be two different people in one clinical, you know, you could be two different people at one time, and how so many patients could come into a doctor and be treated differently based on their appearance and what the doctor might think or perceive of what that person is capable of or how smart they are.
So give inadequate medical treatment because of that?
Sure. Sure, and I don't think it's not even necessarily intentional. It's just about perceptions that people can have of, these things are deep rooted in our society, particularly among, you know, particularly towards young African American men. There's perceptions of threat and violence and, you know, being angry and not being smart and all these sorts of things, and these things creep out. And there's no reason to think that they wouldn't impact everyone in society, and they certainly impact doctors as well. And I don't think it's often a deliberate attempt to provide less adequate care, but in practice, that's what often plays out.
You write about watching a patient at the Grady Memorial Hospital where you worked in Atlanta, a woman named Lucy, go through a code. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yes. Yeah, so it's another issue of how the social impacts the medical. And so that's the one of the great lessons of medical school. It's not just about, you know, science and knowing all the proper medical care. It's about understanding the context of people and their lives. And in her case, she had a son who had been in the legal system and was involved in until he was on probation or something like that. And he was involved in an incident at a nightclub and was arrested after that. And then that basically just sent her over the top because she knew he was going back to prison. And, you know, she was not in great health to begin with, but this sort of incident just tipped her over, and she had a heart attack and a code. And so I was right there to witness all that in the emergency room. And it was just so striking to see how here we are. We know all this medical stuff. We have all this knowledge. But how do we relate to this experience that this woman had? And then not just her, but then we had to tell her family what had taken place. And so it's a deeply sort of powerful experience of trying to deal with life and death and how society impacts health.
You did an emergency run with two paramedics at Grady Hospital. What happened during that day, and what did you learn during that run?
Yeah, it was even more along those same lines, because when you're in a hospital or a clinic, people are coming to you. They're on your turf. You're seeing them within the narrow confines of what's there, but you're not really seeing what is it that's happening on the outside that's bringing people into the clinic. Why are they having the problems that they're having? Why are they not getting better? Why do you see people continue to come in with issues of trauma and violence? And so these are things that you don't necessarily see when you're only seeing them on your turf in the hospital. So at first I really was reluctant to do that. I don't want to, you know, do this rotation, riding out an ambulance with two paramedics or EMS workers, but it was really eye-opening. I mean, we went all through the city, and you just see all the problems, the poverty, and how it impacts health. And so at the very end of that day, we went out to a housing project. And so I'm from the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area. I've certainly seen housing projects, driven through them, had family members who lived in not-so-great areas. But this seemed so different. It was so isolated, and it was out in the woods. And you might think it's a gated community, but until you get up close and you see how horrible it was. And it was like a prison or a psychiatric facility is what it looked like. And then when I was there, you know, we were going to pick up a woman who had had some kind of confrontation, and then I saw these two boys outside playing, and they were playing football, but they were throwing it in the midst of glass and rodents and all cigarette butts and all other sorts of things, and it just made me reflect on how people's opportunities in life, how different they can be, and how, you know, certainly just the unfairness of the system, unfairness of life, but how, you know, we rush to make judgments about people without really understanding the context and the challenges that they actually face. And so it made me realize that here I was at this point, almost a doctor, almost graduated medical school, and was going to have this, you know, really successful future in this way. But it was in some ways hollow if I wasn't trying to doing something that could look at these larger issues and try to address them in some way. And so that was really the lesson of that experience.
You write about Dr. Ben Carson throughout the book. For many Americans, he's probably the only black doctor they've ever seen. And I'm not sure that he always presented himself in the best way. Have you ever met him?
Yes, I have. And so I talk about that in the book. So I met him in the way that I talk about Dr. Carson in the book, so this book was largely written before 2013, before he sort of transformed into a sort of political figure. He was really a tremendous medical hero, particularly among African-American medical students. And what I would find is that every time you'd meet African-American medical students, they always you always have a large number of them who would want to become neurosurgeons because Ben Carson was a neurosurgeon and was so famous among black medical students and doctors. And so it is actually statistical data to show that there are higher numbers of African-American neurosurgeons, you know, proportionally as compared to other ethnic groups. I think a large part is that it was his tremendous influence. And so the book is sort of conceived of in the way I write about Ben Carson is from that lens. I actually had a chance to meet him when I was in college getting ready to choose medical schools between Johns Hopkins and Duke, and he hosted this thing at Johns Hopkins where you get a chance to, meet other African American doctors there at the hospital. So, I have to say, it was a surprise when he it wasn't so much the politics; it was just sort of the way he was sort of presenting what he was saying was so striking because it was very different than the experience that I had had with him and many other doctors had had with him over the years. So it was very striking, and so.
I have to end it here. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I want, again, to remind people that my guest is Dr. Damon Tweedy, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center, Staff Physician at the Durham Veteran Affairs Medical Center. His book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine, is published by Picador. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.